This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. A few years ago, when we discussed Vermont's modernist architecture on Vermont Edition, Middlebury architect John McLeod explained why buildings and design are important to our culture.
It actually can affect the quality of our lives, and whether people are consciously aware of it or not, if a building is designed to be of its place and to relate to the natural surroundings and the sun and the views, it can elevate our experience of life and it can become inspiring.
Vermont architecture in all its glory is our topic today on Vermont Edition. And here to help with that discussion are the co-authors of Buildings of Vermont. It's a new book that chronicles the important styles and architects of Vermont by Curtis Johnson and Glenn Andrus. Glenn Andrus is a Middlebury College professor of the history of art and architecture. Curtis Johnson is a photographer and the former architectural historian for the Vermont Division for Historic Preservation. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
This is not a coffee table book full of large, colorful photos and of mansions and churches. It's more a guidebook that county by county highlights some of the most important buildings and homes in the area. And I thought it was fun. I immediately began paging through the towns near where I live and found all sorts of interesting information on buildings that I drive by all the time. Glenn Andrus, talk about why you and Curtis Johnson felt there was a need for this kind of book.
Well, I became acquainted with a parallel series in England one year when I was there on Fulbright, and I was impressed by the fact that the man on the street in England knows buildings. They would find out I was an architectural historian, and then they would say, oh, have you seen those merchants' houses in such and such a village? And I wondered, why would the butcher know that? And it's because they have a series of books called The Buildings of England, Scotland, and Wales that were created beginning during World War II as a project to raise people's pride in their national heritage. And the Society of Architectural Historians decided to take this on as a project for the United States. And so we jumped at the opportunity to do it for Vermont because the buildings of Vermont are wonderful, but they're relatively little known and they're relatively little published, especially outside of Vermont. And so it seemed to us that this was something that was very important to raise people's consciousness of just what we have here.
Curtis Johnson, when you drive around the state, what styles of architecture do you see the most of? Is there any one particular style that dominates, or is it much more diverse than people realize?
It's much more diverse than I think most people realize. Probably the only architecture I tend not to see is actually a lot of the sort of very modern architecture of the last 20 or 30 years. I think it's easy to say that in the countryside, if you're talking about residences, probably a dominant style is from the middle of the 19th century, a Greek Revival style. And in the larger villages and what we call cities, it's very much more turn of the last century architecture. Queen Anne style architecture would be probably the predominant styles. But there really is great diversity. And it's one of those things that, again, like Glenn was saying, I've had friends who just, you know, didn't even realize I was writing this book, and they read it, and they're like, you know, we used to think Vermont was an architectural backwater, but now we know differently. Thank you. So,
listeners, what are some of your favorite buildings in Vermont, and why? Is there a building in your city or town that you think needs to be noticed? 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call if you have a question or a comment for either of my guests. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. If someone were to ask where to go in Vermont to really see a lot of great architecture, and I don't want to play favorites too much with the towns, Glenn Andrus, where would you suggest they go to really get an eyeful? Is there a hotbed of great design in the state?
Oh, my goodness. I think one of the things we tried to do with this book was to point out that if you just start looking around, you're going to see it on all sides. Vermont probably has the highest density of historically significant buildings of any state in the Union.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
We're a small state. We've got a lot of buildings. And unlike many places, we haven't thrown them out. But there are some hot spots. Burlington is fabulous. It has an incredible history of building from the federal period, so the very early 19th century onwards, and it also became an important center for not only for imported architects from major centers in the country, but also a really strong local building tradition with some strong architectural figures. Early on, the Bennington area is very important for some of our earliest things, which stands to reason because it's a town that was booming well before Burlington took off. St. Johnsbury is a fabulous late Victorian townscape with building after building after building.
Well, I can't imagine. Here you've got this book and you've got to figure out all of the various buildings to put into this book, which ones to highlight, which ones not to. Curtis Johnson, how did you go about divvying up the research that was required for this?
Well, as many authors know, research is kind of the most fun part of any project. So in many ways, I think we did a lot of similar research. And then, of course, we have to acknowledge all the great contributions we received from all the other people who love architecture in Vermont, who have shared their ideas with us. But between Glenn and I, we kind of agreed with some overlap for different buildings that one of us knew better than the other. Glenn worked primarily with state and buildings by state and national architects, and then sort of public buildings and what we'd call the landmarks, you know, the State House, Rockingham Meeting House, the Bennington Battle Monument, this kind of thing. And my orientation, partly just because of my background, is a more vernacular up approach, that being the more rural resources, the farms, the more typical and common architecture. Probably the biggest struggle, though, in allocating our work, or that we spent a lot of time working together on, was how to communicate the aggregate of historic buildings. One thing that's so remarkable about Vermont is not just the individual buildings, but is their grouping in village centers with greens and communities and neighborhoods. And even though the book is oriented to be talking about building by building, we worked very hard to create lots of content which discusses, you know, the context for buildings and great groups of buildings throughout the state, because it's so important to the Vermont environment.
1-800-639-2211 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. Again, we're talking about architecture in Vermont, 1-800-639-2211. Glenn Andrus, I want to ask you briefly, you had all of this ammunition, so many buildings in the state. How did you cull down, I think, from 40,000 buildings to 900 and then eventually down to 650? What criteria did you use to
Well, first off, I think Curtis would debate the 40,000 number, which is an estimated number that the Division for Historic Preservation had at the time we started the book of buildings that are on the state and national registers. The archives of the Division for Historic Preservation are very rich. And one of the things we did was just go through the photographs of all of these buildings to pick out, to list things that were very interesting looking. And then we had to try to come up with buildings that would cover every period, every style, every building type, and every area of the state, so that we would weigh them. And if you had six great federal houses in a town, but that town also had some great Victorian things and some good modern, then maybe we wanted to assign the federal houses to another part of the state so that they would be represented as well.
Right, to spread it around.
So we spread it around, and we cut and cut and cut. And many people will be offended because their favorite buildings won't be in here. But one thing that we did try to do was to select buildings that told more than just the story of that building. In other words, that would help people understand that type of building when they came across it elsewhere. And we've tried to put in some connections in the book, so that the book isn't only talking about 643 buildings, but it's talking about a real building history for the state.
We've got some folks calling in that I'd like to fit in now. Let's take a call from Westminster. Gordon, welcome to Vermont Edition. Go ahead.
Hello. My wife, Mary, and I live in a house that was built in the 1790s by the Ranney family that still lives in the community. And I'm a garden designer, so I'm very aware of the relationship of the house to the land around it. And I was measuring out at the on the west side of the house, facing out on the road a few years ago, and discovered that the road, our dirt road, is 16 feet wide, which is one rod. And then I found fence posts that were 8 feet in from the side of the road, which is a half a rod. The fence posts were 12 feet apart, which is 3/4 of a rod. It was 16 feet from the fence post to the front of the house. The front of the house was 12 feet high. The hallway in the middle of the house is 8 feet wide with two 16-foot rooms either side of it, and on we go.
My guests are nodding as you're giving out all of these proportions.
Yes.
And so,
do you know the basis for the rod?
I understand it's the width of a barn door opening to accommodate the ox and the hay wagon and the attendant men.
It's the width of two yoked teams of oxen. And that established a measurement for fields and for framing in England and then came over here. We've simplified it from 16 and a half feet to about 16, and it became a rule of thumb for framing.
Do you find, gentlemen, do you find a lot when you start looking at these older homes that these proportions are just repeated again and again and again?
Well, we'd like to think that we do, but frankly, there haven't been as many studies as detailed as our caller is submitting. Please document this. Send it into the Vermont Division for Historic Preservation. And, of course, we encourage other homeowners, see what you can find out because needless to say, like of the number of farmsteads and barns that from the late 18th century, I didn't have the luxury of taking a lot of measurements for this book.
Let's go to Shelburne now and take a call from Bruce. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Good morning. Thanks for the show, and can't wait to get my hands on this book. I have a specific architectural question I've had ever since we moved here 7 years ago to the Burlington area, and that was as we drove through downtown Burlington, we would see homes with looked like a square. The homes were most often square, and on top there would be a square cupola, I guess is the only way to describe it, with glass mostly on all four sides. And then I began to start to see it elsewhere throughout the state, and then as we traveled throughout New England a little bit more, but I had never seen it before we moved here from the New York area. Can you talk about that feature and its function and what style it's a part of?
Well, that cupola is actually what was called a belvedere, which comes from the Italian belvedere, and it was a decorative feature that was put on houses in the Italianate period, so coming in the 1840s through up through the time of the Civil War, and then it was carried over into what was called the French Second Empire style that combined it with mansard roofs. But people liked that element, not that they really climbed up in there and looked around at the landscape all that much, but it became a very important mid-Victorian decorative feature.
And it's the kind of thing that you'll see in those early years before the Civil War on very, very grand and very grand homes. And then after the Civil War, you might find it out in Franklin on the top of a house in a rural area up in the 1880s or something.
Bill in East Montpelier emailed us this comment: where and how did the ubiquitous slant-mounted double-hung Vermont farmhouse window originate, and how did it spread to the most remote reaches of the backwoods to farmhouses of very humble means? Same kind of question.
Well, the so-called there's a lot of terms for that. It's called a lazy window, a crazy window, a coffin window is a favorite story. Which, as far as we can tell, has no basis. Basically, it's a way to use a standard stock sash and get light into a space where an L meets the gable end of a building. And so the real reason it's there is that it fits. And it's a way to get an extra window into what is otherwise an unlighted upper half-story space. It is something that does seem to be sort of a regionalism here. You really pretty much see it in Vermont and in New Hampshire. You don't see it a lot much anywhere else. I actually have one in my home between my rear L and my barn.
And I put one in mine 8 years ago.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about a new book about Vermont architecture called Buildings of Vermont. It was co-written by my guests today, Curtis Johnson and Glenn Andrus. Curtis Johnson is a professional photographer, and the former architectural historian for the Vermont Division for Historic Preservation. Glenn Andrus is a Middlebury College professor of the history of art and architecture. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. I want to ask you about some of your favorite buildings. And I know when you have so many and you've cataloged them all, that's not really a fair question. But Glenn Andrus, do you have, you know, a top one or two that you really think everybody in Vermont should take time to see and really appreciate?
I think probably the two most famous buildings in the state are the State House, which has been considered historically one of the very finest Greek Revival buildings in the country. And then the Billings Library at UVM by Henry Hobson Richardson. So those are the two five-star buildings, you might say.
They are both breathtaking.
But then it's really hard.
Then
you've got Rockingham Meeting House. You've got the Bennington Old First Church. You've got the Middlebury Congregational Church. You've got it's really tough. You can't pick a favorite child.
I think I can pick some. I always view this question as, well, what are my favorites today? And today I'd say, hey, the buildings you can visit and go and experience, those are probably going to be my favorites. I'd point to the state-owned historic sites. We have one of the greatest Downing Davis-inspired Gothic Revival houses in the United States in the Morrill Homestead in Stratford. We have a beautifully preserved, Vermont village in Plymouth Notch. And this is the kind of thing, you know, some people will read this book, and for some people reading, this is how they get acquainted with buildings. For some people, you know, you really need to go there to engage your imagination. You know, you walk into an old house, you walk into the Rockingham Meeting House, and then you get the little bit of information that the services here were 8 hours long and there was no heat. And it really helps you creatively imagine really the lives of other people, which is, you know, that sort of humanistic element to these buildings is very central to why we did the book.
Sam posted on Facebook, as far as standouts go, there is, of course, Shelburne Farms, just as you mentioned, and all the lovely weirdness on Prickly Mountain.
Oh,
yes. Glenn Andrus, talk about Prickly Mountain.
Prickly Mountain is actually very important to the history of 20th century architecture in the United States. David Sellers and a group of fellow architects from Yale, young rebels who wanted to build rather than just design conventional things, joined by some other architects from the University of Pennsylvania. David Sellers bought 400 acres on Prickly Mountain in East Warren, and they began self-building wacky houses. And they were purposely challenging the world. This is the 60s. This is when people are rebelling against everything. And so they were purposely in-your-face, crazy buildings. And it's survived. They've changed character some. They've become more permanent. But it's probably the best collection of hippie architecture in the United States. And it became internationally famous and actually generated the Warren and Waitsfield area as still a very important center for quality architecture and design within the state.
Interesting. Listeners, we're talking about architecture in the state. We did have a little phone issue, so I'm going to throw out a new phone number. If you tried calling the regular one and lost the line, that's okay. Try this one. Give us a call at 802-655-2795. Again, the number to call right now while we fix our phone system is 802-655-2795. And we'll try to get to more of your calls and comments when we come back. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and today we're talking about a new book that sheds a light on Vermont's rich architectural heritage. Buildings of Vermont was co-written by my guests Glenn Andrus and Curtis Johnson. And I'm curious, Joe Citro once said of the Fairbanks Museum in St. Johnsbury, it's a museum building that belongs in a museum. I love that. I love that comment. Curtis Johnson, what makes that building so significant?
Well, it's really a time machine. It's a way to go and actually see to see what a museum from the end of the 19th century looked like. It really has not changed. The building was designed to house Albert Bierstadt's Domes of Yosemite and the art collection, and so it's really a building that's designed around the display of the art collection. It's also one of the masterpieces produced through the patronage of the Fairbanks family with their favorite architect, Lambert Packard. And like so many of the great buildings in Vermont, it's a public building. It's the kind of thing you can go in there and visit it, and you will literally be transported back 120 years.
Glenn Andrus, I want to ask you, we haven't talked much about Vermont architects, and Lambert Packard is someone that I think we should mention today and talk a little about. What made his contribution significant?
Lambert Packard was one of the most prolific architects of the late 19th century in Vermont. We had a series of people that I like to consider the great Victorians. In his case, he was the personal architect to the Fairbanks family, so that he had this fantastic patronage. But he went off and he did some training in Boston. He came back and he had this uncanny relationship with the work of Henry Hobson Richardson. We don't know quite how he knew Richardson's designs, but in some cases he even knew Richardson unbuilt designs. And he had an ability to combine very fine mainstream Richardsonian details from a number of – they're identifiable from a number of Richardson buildings, and he would combine them in his own building. So we can even name the Richardson buildings that he looked at to design his own buildings. But he was one of the finest what we would call Richardsonian Romanesque architects in the whole country, and also in a way one of the most – literal and one of the most competent. They're not mere copies. They're really fine, fine buildings in their own right.
I'd like to talk about another architect and bring another voice into the conversation right now. Janet Burnham is vice president of the Bethel Historical Society, a group that has just published a book about Vermont architect George Guernsey, who lived in Vermont throughout the mid and late 1800s. Janet Burnham, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you for asking me.
So the Vermont Historical Society describes Guernsey as Vermont's elusive architect. Why is that?
Well, because as far as we know, we weren't able to ever discover his papers, so we had no official list of what he did. And the more we looked, the more we found that he had done. He was all over the state. We've got a list here of 41 different buildings in Vermont and two in New Hampshire, and there undoubtedly are more. Those are the ones we were able to track down.
So why did your group want to write about him?
Well, when we looked at our town hall here in Bethel and began to talk about renovating it, one of the things we talked about was, well, who designed it? And it was George H. Guernsey. So that just made us a little curious, and we talked to Lisa Papazian, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing her name correctly, but she had just done architectural history about the South Royalton schoolhouse, which also was a Guernsey building. So we just started out saying, well, let's see what else he's done.
Well, and I understand besides designing buildings, he served as mayor of Montpelier for a while. And in the book, I think you've called Montpelier the town that Guernsey built. So he was quite prolific with designing buildings there as well?
Well, he was. And part of that was because just after he arrived in Montpelier, there were a couple of big fires. And so he did a lot of business blocks replacing what had been burned. And he did a number of private homes. The private homes are really hard to track down because most town records do not record who the architect of a particular house was. Mm. So unless that information has been passed down through owners, you have no idea.
Janet Burnham is vice president of the Bethel Historical Society, which just published a book about the elusive Vermont architect George Guernsey. Janet, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Glenn Andrews, I want to ask you to comment both on the book and the architect.
Okay. I would say that George Guernsey is another of these great Victorians, and he's unusual in that usually they tended to work in a particular area. For instance, Lambert Packard was working mostly in Caledonia County. Clinton Smith, primarily in the Middlebury area. We have over 100 documented buildings by him. But in the case of George Guernsey, he was all over the state. And he was an important church builder. And the only way to assemble him was to begin to pick up a building here, a building there. I really have to congratulate the Bethel Historical Society on this work. This is one of the exciting things about working with Vermont architecture. We know relatively little about it. And as soon as you start digging, all of these things start coming out. You turn over this stone and it leads to something else. And all of a sudden, we're assembling pictures that we didn't know existed. And it's just – it's a beginning of history. And we need to go on. We think that this book is just an introduction to the history of the genre in the state.
Let me get a couple callers in now. Let's hear from Ruth, who's calling in from Springfield. Hi, Ruth. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I would like to hear something about Manchester Village from your guests and Mount Equinox. In the village, I'm curious about the Equinox Hotel.
Ooh.
And the surrounding houses.
Well, let me ask our guest that. Glenn Andrus.
Well, the Equinox has an interesting, very complex history. And it has been well studied, but it started out as a series of separate taverns that then were remodeled and tied together with Greek Revival architecture to form one really large destination, resort hotel. But then the builders also combined shops and an old courthouse and some other buildings across the street in order to they created an entire townscape of Greek Revival architecture. I think there's nothing like it anywhere else in the country. And it fell on hard times, but it's been beautifully restored as a destination resort, and it has preserved this remarkable townscape. But then the village also has things like Burr and Burton Academy, this superb stone academy building. It has the courthouse. It's the northern shire town for Bennington County, which, as I recall, is our oldest active courthouse in the state. There are treasures all over in that village. And then, of course, it became a very important place for summer people in the late 19th century, so that they built really grand homes around there.
Jack in Cornwall asks, how many of the buildings you report on will still be around 10, 20, 50 years from now? And what are the major threats to our architectural heritage? Curtis Johnson.
Well, we don't know. The buildings, as Glenn explained how we selected the buildings, we didn't select them for priority in preservation. There are so many buildings worth preserving that, the fact that something isn't included in the book doesn't mean that it shouldn't be preserved. But we're optimistic that we're talking, 90, 95% of what we see in here, we hope will be around.
Let me go back to the phone lines. I want to take a call from Wade, who's calling in from Woodstock. Hi, Wade. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Great program, and look very forward to getting my hands on this book. I have been a restoration contractor for upwards of 40 years, and more recently being involved in real estate. But one of the things I want to bring up that I found, I had the good fortune of crawling around in the attics and the basements and the innards of, you know, many, many of the significant houses and buildings in Vermont. But I think one of the more intriguing things that I got involved in was when I was president of the Woodstock Historical Society, I started researching the Charles Marsh Law Office. And this was a fairly small structure, actually quite a small structure, that was built and was at 24 Elm Street. Well, Charles Marsh built this in 1797 and later sold that lot, which became the Dana Dry Goods Store, and moved his law office down the street on Elm Street.
Wait, I'm going to ask you, our time is running short, so just if you could form your question or comment, I want to make sure my guests have a chance to respond.
Certainly. My point with this building was moved four times, and as I studied it, the framing was such that he originally built this building to be moved, and yet it was a very high-style building with raised paneling, great detailing, and as I looked throughout the state, I found many more examples of professional buildings which were ancillary to the owner's buildings, and wondered if you were familiar with these. I know there's the Bradley Law.
Well, let me throw it. Like I said, our time is short, so let me throw that to Glenn Andrus. Do you hear about fancy buildings that are designed to be moved?
Well, actually, a post and beam building lends itself to being picked up and moved. Barns are moved. These ancillary buildings are moved all the time, and it's great because they've survived as a result. They're rigid structures, so they're easy to put on wheels and get some oxen.
The new book is called Buildings of Vermont. Listeners, you can find out more about it on our website, vpr.net. Glenn Andrus is a Middlebury College professor of the history of art and architecture. Curtis Johnson is a professional photographer. Gentlemen, it was great talking with you today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can see an exhibit of photographs of some of the buildings featured in the book at the Middlebury College Museum of Art. You can find a link again at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Coming up, are you one of those people who thinks venison is gamey, dry, hard to cook? Well, stick around because we've invited Chef Jimmy Kennedy to share some of his favorite venison recipes, and you're going to love them. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. If you got a deer last fall, you probably have some meat left in the freezer, and you're probably tired of all your tried-and-true venison recipes by now. Well, have no fear. We've invited Chef Jimmy Kennedy onto the show today to share some of his favorite venison recipes. Kennedy was the co-founder of River Run Restaurant in Plainfield and the author of the River Run Cookbook. He's now a chef for the Cabot Creamery Company and develops recipes for them. Jimmy, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you say it drives you crazy when people describe venison as gamey, and I have to say I'm guilty of that. So what should really well-prepared venison taste like?
Well, good venison has a rich, full flavor, and to me, it's elegant. It's also very simple at the same time, and I think a lot of people get that gamey flavor, or what they call gamey flavor, because maybe they're not familiar with venison and they're looking for beef, which is, of course, very different and needs to be cooked differently. And also, the people could get a gamey flavor if the game's not properly taken care of from the field to the table. I mean, it's important if you want to end up with a tasty dish on the table, you need to take care of your game. And I know the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department's put a lot of effort into this, into care of game and cooking, and they're even developing some new hunter ed classes that address this.
You were mentioning that people expect venison to be like beef, and I think a lot of people have probably tried different ways to prepare venison steak. But you've brought a recipe with you today that gives a little something extra to that idea, venison steaks with a red wine and cherry sauce. And that sounds really great, I have to say. So talk us through how you prepare that dish.
It's a tasty dish for sure. And I start out with about a pound of venison steaks, and they can be an inch thick or as thick as you want. And I prefer tenderloin or even parts of the hind quarter for this. And you just take a little crushed garlic along with that and some fresh thyme and salt and pepper, olive oil, dry red wine, and maybe some dried cherries or even pitted cherries fresh. And you can use some berry or grape jelly to go along with this and some Cabot butter. And what you do is you just pat the venison nice and dry with a paper towel. And using your hand, just kind of pat the thyme, salt and pepper all over the venison. You can even throw in some crushed juniper berries, which goes very well with venison. And heat up a cast iron skillet over pretty hot heat. You don't want it smoking, but nice and hot. And just throw the steaks right in there, throw the garlic right on top of that, and just cook for about 4 or 5 minutes on each side. You want to just sear that. And good venison should be cooked kind of medium rare, so you don't want to overcook it. And that's another issue with venison. You have to be careful not to overcook. And when that's done, just take it out, let it rest for a little bit. Pour the wine in the same skillet with the cherries and the thyme, maybe the juniper berries, and just bring that to a boil and kind of scrape up any of the brown bits. Whisk in that jelly, swirl in the butter, turn off the heat, and you're good to go. Oh,
that sounds really yummy.
It's very simple, too.
So you grew up in Mississippi, and your family has a strong tradition with hunting and fishing. And I'm wondering, how did you learn to cook wild game and fish?
Well, growing up, like you said, in rural northeast Mississippi, hunting and fishing both were just a huge part of my childhood. And it was so important also. It's just a great way to spend time with family, and it was something I always looked forward to. And all of my uncles, all relatives, friends hunted and fished for just about everything. It was very important to put this food on the table in a proper manner as well. And, you know, it was more the farm-to-table and even the field-to-table with gardens was such a way of life for us. It was more of that than a trend, I would say.
Are you seeing more venison on the menu when you travel to other restaurants?
Oh, definitely. I'm at all over the country. I mean, I'm fortunate I get to travel a lot with my job with Cabot, and I try to eat out as much as possible and go to, you know, restaurants that I've heard about or are interested in. And even Asian restaurants now are serving venison, I've noticed, and it's used in just about everything now.
Well, another recipe you brought along that I want to ask you to share is venison negamaki, and that sounds really interesting.
It's one of my favorites. I love this one.
Talk us through that one.
Well, I love Japanese food, and my family and I, we go to eat sushi as much as we can. And negamaki is like a beef scallion roll. And you just take the venison, say you want some two probably thin boneless steaks, 4 or 5 ounces each. And you want these as thin as possible, so just take some wax paper and put them on a cutting board and just pound them with a meat mallet or even the back of a glass bottle or something, so they're nice and thin. And once you have that, you just take scallions, either a whole scallion or a split scallion lengthwise. And looking at the venison, it's going to be kind of like a oblong rectangle. And just picture that. And then starting on from the longwise, lengthwise, just put the scallion on there. And then maybe even I like to put some Cabot cheddar in there as well occasionally. And I roll that up, put toothpicks in it, and then dip it in a teriyaki sauce, barbecue teriyaki, which is just equal parts of barbecue sauce, soy sauce, and sherry or sake, and just grill it for 3 or 4 minutes, and it is so good. And what you do is you take it, you have this cylinder, you take it off the grill, and you just cut it in like 1.5 to 2-inch pieces and stand it up on the cut end.
And it's probably really pretty to look at.
It's beautiful. And then you just put a little more teriyaki sauce over it. It's delicious.
Oh, one more recipe I think we have time for. Okay. And this is venison meatloaf, which that one kind of surprised me. But a lot of people have ground up venison in their freezer, so this sounds perfect.
Well, a lot of parts of venison should be ground up, probably like the shanks, the front shoulders, even rib meat. You know, you want to cook those either low and slow is kind of the key, braising, or you want to grind them up into burger, which – I really enjoy doing it. I make sausage. And this is another one of my favorite recipes. And what I use is probably about a pound of venison to a half a pound of ground pork or loose sausage. And this adds a little fat to the venison, which, of course, is very lean. And it just gives it a great flavor. And I believe these recipes will be on your website.
They absolutely will be, yes.
And check this one out. I mean, it's a little lengthy in the ingredients, so I won't go through it. But when you make this, And before you put it in the baking pan, just mound it kind of like a football shape with your hands so you get it nice and tight, and then put it in the loaf pan and put barbecue sauce on top of it. And you'll be making this a lot, I think. It's really good.
Well, like I said, we will have all of these recipes on our website, so don't despair if you went through the directions too fast. How does venison compare to beef when it comes to the nutrition and health benefits? Just briefly.
Okay, well, venison, first of all, it's as local as it can get. I mean, it's free range, without a doubt, and depending on its diet, it can be organic. And I mean, venison's been feeding families for millions of years, and for good reason. It's very high in protein. It's extremely low in fat and saturated fat. It has about half the calories of beef, and it's loaded with vitamins and minerals, especially iron.
Well, I think you've converted me. Like I said, I was a doubting Thomas, but we do have venison in our freezer, so I'm kind of excited.
You're lucky.
Jimmy Kennedy is an outdoorsman and chef. He's author of the River Run Cookbook. We've posted the venison recipes that we talked about today online. Go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Feel free to share them with the hunters that you know. Jimmy, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
We've been reading the emails and comments that you've sent in, and we wanted to share some of them with you. Vermont Edition producer Sage Van Wing is here to help with that. Hi, Sage.
Hi, Nina. On Friday, we had a robust discussion about a bill that would require Vermont employers to give their workers 7 paid sick days each year. Al in West Berkshire shared his support for the idea. He writes, "I'm all for paid sick days for my own health and peace of mind. Those without paid sick days are more likely to work while sick because they can't afford to lose pay or their jobs. A law is necessary because even the once honorable IBM is making cutbacks to employee benefits like paid sick days."
Moving on to our Olympics coverage yesterday, Mark Stephen, who happens to be the dad of cross-country Olympian Liz Stephen, disagrees with our guest yesterday who said the women's relay team is a long shot for a medal.
Mark writes, "The U.S. women's team goal of a podium is not such a long shot, as you suggest. In the last 5 World Cup relays, the U.S. women have had only one tough result, 8th, if memory serves, and 1/4 at last year's World Championships. The other 3 have all been third-place finishes. The beauty of sport is, in part, the uncertainty of result. But the U.S. women have a very, very solid chance to podium on Saturday."
And we discovered in yesterday's show that there are just too many talented Olympians in our region and not enough time in Vermont Edition to do them justice. Wyatt in Canaan was waiting to hear us mention Nolan Casper of Warren, who's competing in men's slalom.
Wyatt writes, "Nolan attended the Burke Mountain Academy with Liz Stephen, Michaela Schifrin, and Ida Sargent, who have all been mentioned in today's program. Nolan stood on a World Cup podium last year and always can be a contender. Thanks for giving him his due." And Jim writes about another athlete. "Don't forget Devin Logan of West Dover."
Devin Logan, who won a silver medal earlier today in women's ski slope style, is just one of the athletes from Vermont competing in Sochi, and we don't want to forget any of them. Follow their progress at the Olympics online at vpr.net. We have photos, we have bios, and we have results posted there for all the Vermont Olympians in Sochi.
And finally, one listener didn't love our choice of topics last week.
Oh, no.
On Tuesday, we learned about research to use human urine as fertilizer for crops. And on Thursday, we heard about an effort to normalize the use of insects in our daily meals.
Trudy in St. Johnsbury writes, "First urine, now bugs at lunchtime. Not good."
Trudy, we hope our chat about venison earlier this hour made up for it.
A listener using the name No Stopping Progress posted on our website, "When traveling the back roads of Vermont, my wife and I are always surprised by the large size and quality workmanship of many homes from the 18th and 19th century. Vermont is often portrayed as fairly poor before the 1960s. Were there really that many wealthy Vermonters, or were these flatlanders who built second homes here, and how did their important style affect Vermont architecture?" That's a comment from today's program, and you can keep the architecture discussion going online. Sage Van Wing, thanks very much. I appreciate your help today.
You're welcome, Nina.
And that's it for today. Tomorrow on the show, protecting water quality in Vermont's lakes by limiting development on the lakeshore. A shoreline protection bill passed the Senate last week and will soon be ready for the governor to sign. We'll talk about how the bill will impact landowners and the lakes they live on. Send your comments or questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Nina Kack. Thanks for listening.